Welcome to the 9th episode of the Baptizing Philosophy Podcast. I'm here with Nate and Allhart to talk about the idea of universal history and other related matters. We're doing this topic with these fellas because our guest dropped out at the last moment and we're really, really angry with him. But so we scrambled this together at the last moment. So first of all, universal history. This is something that you two know a lot more about than me. So I'm going to send it off to Allhart first to sort of give a general introduction to the idea of universal history. What, how does it differ from actual history? Or is there, can you make the difference as straightforward as many may think? Maybe you can, maybe you can't. Let's find out from Allhart.
All right, so to lay some definitions for the term universal history for this conversation, I'm going to give one that's more esoteric and one that's more exoteric. The esoteric one, for those who are in the know of, you know, with regards to Telos Bound and its whole project of communal ontology, the definition with regards to that is basically you can understand universal history as the communal ontology in the context of narrative. And to expand on that with the other definition, you can understand universal history as the process by which cultures which convert to Christianity are simultaneously digested by and digest Christianity. So they both become integrated into the Christian story of history, both biblical and classical, and they both kind of bring their own history, pre-Christian history, into that broader Christian narrative. And so that's basically how you can understand universal history in broad strokes. Universal is the history of all peoples, right? It's basically a project which seeks to and sought historically as a tradition within the Christian church to basically create a universal narrative in which it's like this massive tapestry where all the different peoples of the earth have their stories stitched together into one whole, which is connected to the touchstones of classical and biblical history. And I'm sure we'll expand on this later. So, yeah.
Nate, do you have anything to add?
True.
True.
No, that was a good kind of brief overview. Yeah, universal history is exactly what the name says. It's just the history of everybody. It's the history of but also within universal history, it's not just the past, it's also about the continual integration of the nations, and not just the integration of the nations within Christianity, but then the expansion of these nations' identity as it exists within Christianity, which is to say, as it exists in its truest form, the expansion of this identity into all the different cultural modes of expression that we see, like with art, music, all these different things, architecture. We see how Christianity allows this culture to become fully itself and truly become a unique culture. And unless Trey has something to add to this, we can actually use this as a segue to talk about how this relates to the Tower of Babel or that sort of section of universal history. Like how do we get to where we are today with different cultures?
Well, firstly, maybe before we go into that, we can talk a little bit more about the general idea. Dog barking in the back, I don't know if you can hear that, but the general idea of universal history, oh, you can't, okay, that's good, is to me it seems to be is based on the idea that there is like a pattern, like a fundamental pattern to reality. And as Allhart was saying, that pattern for us in the Christian story, I think a good word for it is communion, because the idea, the way in which we understand reality as something unfolding is that is what is revealed by Jesus Christ, which is that the purpose, the telos of the world, of history itself, is a union between God and man. So that union, it seems to me that pattern, if you could call it that, seems to be what is uniting all of these different individual histories into this universal history, because all of them are fit within the pattern in their own unique ways, in a way which doesn't just negate the uniqueness of these individual peoples. And if we actually look at the history, like if you listen to Peugeot's talks about universal history, he gives all these examples of the way in which different cultures understood their own history after becoming Christianized. And it wasn't just, they just like forgot all about their pre-Christian history. If you, that even, I guess that does make sense, but not in the sense that they were absolutely disconnected from what we would call the Christian story. The whole point of universal history is that they do have a place within it. And the idea of universal history is kind of revealing what, how they fit within this general pattern of that underlies all of history itself. So I don't know if that was like a sufficient explanation of that idea, but I think it is important to touch on like the idea that we're dealing with a pattern of meaning where people are different cultures and histories and lineages are brought in their own irreducibly unique way. But they do still fit in within the pattern precisely because it is a universal pattern that is like a one in the many idea, right? It's like a unity in diversity. Go ahead, Nate. You have your hand raised.
Thanks, Trey. Yeah. So the thing that we have to understand about the idea of universal history, specifically within the Christian context, is that the nation's accepting of the story of Christ, which is the story of all reality. And I mean, if you want to substitute the story of Christ for just the pattern of like the world, like what Trey was just talking about, how there's this underlying pattern which exists, which permeates all of reality. It's just that that story is the story of Christ. This means that the nation's embracing of this pattern and expression of this pattern in their own unique way is not just a contingent reality on top of the nation's identity. It's the center of their identity, and it is what permeates the nation's identity, not just moving forward, but also, like Trey said, retroactively goes back and rewires everything that's already happened in this culture towards this newfound center of truth, which is the pattern by which all of reality exists.
Right, exactly. So it's not merely like this kind of ham-fisting in which these different cultures just kind of like are forced into the biblical story. Because if you understand the full scope of the biblical story as paradigmatic for history as a whole, it's not arbitrary. It's an unveiling of actual like metaphysical realities. So you mentioned it, I mentioned before, this is why I said it's an extension of the communal ontology. It's simply the communal ontology in the context of human history and of narrative, because it's the unveiling of who these peoples, these nations that make up humanity truly are. It's not merely a kind of just like, well, we gotta like bring these people in. It's actually a revelation of their positive character. So you can look at, if we want to get concrete about like universal history, probably the best place to look is Peugeot's series and Sarrow's conversation with Peugeot. We'll probably link those in like the description or something. And people who haven't checked those out absolutely should. But it's basically, if you want to understand it, like for instance, the Hungarians, they connected themselves when they became Christian to the figure of Nimrod in the Old Testament. Who is a hunter before the Lord, right? And so they connected their like past history as nomads. If you know anything about the history of the Hungarians, they basically came out of the steppes of southern Siberia and like moved into the center of Europe and then converted to Christianity and became a true nation. And yeah, so basically it's based on the ontological characteristics of the peoples in question. Where they get connected to the classical and biblical narratives is not arbitrary. It is actually based on the ontological, like the national character, the spiritual character of these people groups in question. And it unveils something like truly there about their character. And it's not merely positive, because obviously the figure of Nimrod has a negative aspect as well. So it's a balanced tradition that kind of explains through connections to through connecting these people groups to the classical and biblical narratives, both good and bad, or positive and negative aspects of these people groups in a way that is like actually revelatory for who they are.
Right. So it probably would be useful now that we've got the abstract stuff and the definitions laid out to go into concrete ideas about this. So I know Nate was going to talk about the Tower of Babel. So you can do that now, Nate.
Sweet. So I'm sure everybody listening knows the story of the Tower of Babel, all these different cultures, all these different nations, the 70 nations, they came together under Nimrod and they built this big tower. It was probably kind of like a pyramid sort of thing, or like a, what's the word? Is it a ziggurat? Is that the word? Yeah. Like a ziggurat sort of thing. And they were building it because they wanted to create like the single body for identity to express itself in the world, because the whole thing was like, oh, let's make a name for ourselves. A name is the essence of a thing. A name tells you what a thing is. It is everything about that thing. It's what allows you to distinguish that thing from any other given thing. So them saying, let us make a name for ourselves, is them saying, let us create an identity for ourselves to express ourselves in and through. They're basically making themselves as the center of their own identity and their own cultural expression. Now, obviously, this has implications for, or this has implications in the more philosophical side of things that Trey and I have both talked about before on this channel, but we're not going to get too into that today. We're going to talk about how this is relevant on a historical level. So Tower of Babel, they're coming together, they're creating an identity for themselves, for all people in the world to express themselves through. You can think about the building of a tower or a building of like a ziggurat or a pyramid or a temple. You can think about this as a construction of a body for the divine to reveal itself in, because throughout Genesis, that's the purpose of building sacred architecture. And it's the purpose of building architecture in general. It's the idea of providing a body for a head or for an identity, the heaven side of things to express itself in and through. So them creating, and they didn't just create the tower, they created the tower and the city, right? The cult and the culture. They created a religion and a nation and a culture. They had one lip and one language. Sarah from Hamilton has talked about this plenty of times, how this is both a religion and a culture, because the two are ultimately they're inseparable from each other. But anyways, think about the building of the tower as them building a body for the divine or the sacred to reveal itself in. But they made themselves the divine in this case, and they decided to construct their own idea of what it means for humanity to exist as a united organism. And that's with humanity at the top of the tower, because they said they wanted to build a tower that would reach the heavens. Why would they want to reach the heavens other than to be the ones at the top of the tower? Because at the top of the tower, you know, pyramid, mountains, they all have this structure where the top of the tower is that source of identity, which gives identity up to the rest of the rest of the structure. So the only reason that they would want to build it to reach the heavens is so that they could go and sit at the top and be the source of identity. But ultimately, this obviously failed, because it's impossible to create your own cultural identity just by saying, this is our cultural identity.
It is like a repetition of the original sin, of the original fall, because in the same way that they are trying to construct their own identity in this way, they're trying to seize what is proper to the heavens, right, to the divine. Adam and Eve on Eden is a mountain, and since the garden is the tree of knowledge would have been at the center, to my understanding, they would have gone to the peak of the mountain. They would have tried to seize that identity for themselves, seize knowledge of good and evil for themselves. And we know that this is what unites them with heaven in this way, in some sense, because what does God say once they've done this? He says to the heavenly host, to the angels, he says, they have become like us, knowing the knowledge of good and evil. So we know that at the peak of the mountain, where this is where the divine and human meet, both symbolically and really in the Bible. And this is what Adam and Eve tried to take for themselves. And you see this fundamental pattern of sin, which is ultimately the pattern of self-relation, you could call it, or trying to take yourself as self-ultimate, self-constituting, without humility, without receiving what is ultimately a gift. You try to take that, what is ultimately a gift, and act like it comes from yourself, that's a self-destructive act, because you don't have that gift of life, of knowledge, of anything within yourself. It's always received from above. But these people, this is what sin also ultimately is. This is what Adam and Eve did. And this is what you see at a collective scale with the folks at the Tower of Babel.
Exactly. Or the folk. They made themselves one folk.
Yeah. Das
but but funny you bring up Garden of Eden, because we can think about the Tower of Babel, yeah, as a repeat of the sin of the Garden of Eden. Not just that it was a sin, a transgression against God, but it was a transgression against fellow man. What's the first thing that happens when God confronts Adam about his fall? Hey, listen, it's the woman you gave me. She made me do it. Mm-hmm. And there was this immediate betrayal of not just man against God, but man against man, or, well, in that case, man against woman, but you get what I'm saying, person against person. This is exactly what we see happen in the Tower of Babel as well. And that's because every sin that happens is not just a misalignment of yourself with the vertical axis. You can think about like the structure of the cross. There's vertical, you and God, and then there's horizontal, you with the world around you, or you with fellow man. And every sin that you commit is always a misplacing of that center of the cross, which disrupts not just the vertical, but the horizontal as well. So at the Tower of Babel, what we see happen, and just before I continue, this is very clearly laid out. This pattern of reality is very clearly laid out by Christ, who says that the whole law can be summarized by love God and love your neighbor. Align yourself within the hierarchy of things, not just on the vertical axis, but on the horizontal axis as well, with God and with man. And it's in the aligning of yourself with fellow man that you become aligned with God naturally. The horizontal leads to the vertical. And that's the whole idea of what a mountain is. It's as you move closer to the center horizontally, you're also moving closer to the top vertically. So this is just the way that reality works. So at the Tower of Babel, what happens is it's this destruction of what it means for a culture to exist as a culture. And something that needs to be said, because it's not something that I even really realized until I actually looked into the text of Genesis 10, or like I actually really read it, but there were different languages and actual expressions of culture that existed before the Tower of Babel. Oftentimes we have this idea that everybody just spoke the same language pre-Babel, and then post-Babel, all these languages were created and it's a bad thing. That's not true. There were different languages. In Genesis 10, it gives the genealogy of Japheth, and it says, and they all went out and they had their own languages. They all went to their own land and had their own languages, something like that. I'm paraphrasing, but it says that they all had their own languages. Same thing with Ham, so on and so forth. So the expression of your own language, and remember, language has to do with names. It's how you express your interaction with the world around you. It's not just the description of things in relation to other things. It's also the description of how you relate to those various things. There's a reason that different languages have different syntax. They have different rhythms in their speech. They have different words that are related to different words. They have different etymological trees, I guess you could say. And that's because different cultures have these different expressions of their relation with reality. And that's a good thing. Obviously, it was a good thing because it was the sin of the Tower of Babel was destroying that and getting rid of that. It was basically saying, listen, all of you guys are wrong, or not just that you guys are wrong, but it was like this rejection of the otherness of other cultures, and it was the forceful construction of this false language, this false naming of reality, Nimrod's forcing of everybody to abide by his relation to all things. And obviously that's impossible, because not everybody is Nimrod. So yeah, that's where the Tower of Babel went wrong. If you want to take over, Allheart.
Yeah. So what you said is significant. Basically, you have to understand, dear viewer, that history is always one step backwards and two steps forwards. So this is why God, you know, brings all things together for good. This is how, you know, evil things like the Bolshevik Revolution and, you know, the Ottoman conquest of Constantinople and so forth and so on can ultimately lead to a good outcome. Is history always is one step backwards, two steps forwards. And the actual multiplication of the nations as a result of the like breakdown of at Babel, where the failure of Nimrod to contain all things in himself is manifest, the product of that, which is the breaking up of all these people groups and diversifying of all of humanity into these different nations in greater abundance than before. Basically, that is a good thing. So God always used the wicked for good. God always used wickedness for good. And if you have like a cosmos perspective, which we don't even need to get into yet, this is how you understand things like the Bolshevik Revolution being positive as well, in a consequentialist sense, almost. God is the only one who can be a consequentialist is almost a way to think of it. Because God is the only one who permeates and has perfect knowledge of all things and is utterly humble because of the Trinity, right? So yeah, this is how we understand history is bad things are always used for the multiplication of good. That doesn't make them not bad, but they can be used for good. And Babel is an example of this. Another example is Noah's Ark. And this is relevant to universal history because for instance, all these people groups that became Christian will relate themselves to one of Noah's descendants, one of Noah's sons or one of Noah's sons. So like Europe gets associated with Japheth, and Shem gets associated with Asia, and Ham gets associated with Africa, and so forth and so on. So if you look at the Ark of Noah, right, it's a technological endeavor to build the Ark. And actually, if you look at Genesis 6 and so forth and so on, and you know something about the Nephilim traditions, you know that technology was, like if you look at the Book of Enoch, was given to man by demons to, it's the same thing as with the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil. It's something that was given to man before he was ready to destroy him. And this is how we understand technology. And it's, so in that sense, it's something bad, but the conclusion is not Ludditism that technology is evil, contrary to what some kind of ultra trads would have you believe. The conclusion is that God actually transfigures this and baptizes it. And this is the form of the Ark in which technology, technics, is not only something that is not bad, but it's actually something that gets bound up with the very process of salvation. Because of course, Noah's rescuing of the animals and of his family from the flood via the ark, which is an object of technics, is an image of salvation. It is a kind of salvation. So amen, yeah, this amen. Is basically—
What are we doing right now? We're using technology for good, I think.
Right, exactly. Yeah, inshallah. I hope. Yeah.
Right. So like, yeah, were you going to continue with like the specific example of, or like with specific examples of like, like in the case of Noah's Ark, like how does universal history, because I'm really new to this idea actually, like how would this relate to just sort of like the empirical, like gathering of historical facts where like you can actually demonstrate how like different cultures had like the idea of a Noah story. Like this is kind of why, like this is sort of like a reason why the biblical worldview makes more sense. It's one of the most convincing arguments to me. The fact that there are ancient Native American traditions, not just one, literally hundreds of them from all of these different tribes from all across the continent, which all had not just stories of a global flood, like you'll hear that a lot. Oh, there's this idea of a flood or even just a local flood, but the idea of a dude who builds like a canoe or something and then sends an otter out of his boat in the exact same way Noah built the ark and then sent the dove. So like what would, in that example where you're kind of just like doing actual, like this is like almost like an archaeological and anthropological endeavor to look at these different cultures and just see where they would fit in within an objective historical timeline. And then these would actually be, this would be evidence for obviously modern archaeologists and anthropologists don't tend to take these sorts of striking similarities into account because it completely is a total challenge to their worldview. But for us, it makes total sense because everyone comes from the line of Noah. Everyone comes from one man and his children. So they are all spreading the same oral tradition about Noah. That's why you have the Noah story everywhere, from Native American tribes to China, all of these ancient stories. And then universal history, how would it fit in with these sort of specific like empirical historical examples of people that are that relate to the biblical story in this way?
Yeah, so yeah, I think that kind of stuff would dovetail very nicely with any kind of universal history tradition. I think these are the kinds of things that the ancient authors of universal history, who we can perhaps touch on, would latch onto very readily. But what you'll see with what's primary with the universal history tradition historically is a kind of ontological understanding of these people groups, and then connecting them to figures in the classical and biblical tradition and history. But that, if you understand, like, there's no dialectic between heaven and earth, between meaning and matter, then that actually could be relative, like, revelatory of like an actual historical reality. And I don't think that's far-fetched at all. Mm-hmm. So yeah. And so that's basically how I see the relationship. Historically, it's based on like the ontology of these people groups, like their characteristics as a people, and how that relates to the characteristics of individuals or people groups in the Bible and in the classical tradition. When I mean classical tradition, I mean like the Greco-Roman civilizational heritage, Troy, the Iliad, the Aeneid, the Odyssey. Well,
maybe we could get into that, like the specifics of that. Like, we've already done sort of a video on this with the Greek philosophers. We did this video on how there's like a pattern, a typological correspondence between the three main philosophers up until Christ, and the three patriarchs up until Moses. So the three philosophers paving the way, even if unknowingly, towards the new covenant. Then you see the three patriarchs paving the way to the old covenant. So that's like one example of sort of a typological correspondence there. And there's a lot of stuff, like in Peugeot's series, they talk a lot about the classical tradition. So what are some like concrete examples of like the classical tradition being baptized in this way, brought into a Christian universal history? Because obviously that would have been done because obviously the Roman Empire was Christianized. So they there probably was like this in their consciousness, like a feeling that they had to find a way for these for the two narratives to fit together in a way. And I guess the universal history contention would be that there isn't like it's not difficult, really. It does fit quite nicely because we have actually found the universal pattern in the Christian story.
Right. So you'll see, for instance, the story of the Battle of the Milvian Bridge, in which Saint Constantine defeats the opposing emperor and actually unites the Roman Empire in under one emperor once again. People have mentioned the fact that parallels very much the story of Exodus. There's the crossing of a body of water, which leads to the foundation of a new world. You can see that in the story of Noah and the Ark, you know, transition from one world to the other, from the antediluvian to the post-diluvian by crossing water, crossing of the Red Sea with the Israelites from one world to another. The story Jonah, it's a basically resurrectional pattern, because obviously water represents this like death or primordial chaos, which must be like traversed to create a new world, to render the world anew. And so, yeah, specifically with the classical tradition, so we can see basically it is being, this is why I brought up the language of actually digestion, which might have put some people off, but basically it's the idea of mutual indwelling. It's actually a biblical image. So like in the book of Revelation, it speaks of, you know, Christ basically like eating Christians basically. And if they're lukewarm, he spits them out of his mouth. Right. And we eat Christ in the Eucharist. So it's this language of mutual indwelling, like Christ, like integrates us, like in the way, like we eat to rejuvenate the cells in our body. He eats us and we eat him. And it's this mutual indwelling, which is why I brought up the language of digestion and of eating. And you can kind of view basically the relationship between Christianity and the various people groups and cultures it encounters as that same kind of pattern, this relationship between this like a mutual indwelling mutual like digestion of the other. And so that's basically how you can understand it. And so like we can see this concretely in the example of like the sanctification of the Roman Empire in the form of like the Holy Imperium. So that would be like the classical edifice getting digested by Christianity and digesting it as well, because from this conversion of the empire, this baptism of the empire, you get the ecumenical councils as called by the emperor. So that it's this mutual influence that reveals and truly like stitches back together the creation. And we can see this also in the way Christianity made contact with like the kind of northern barbarians, the Germanic tribes, and the way there was kind of mutual interchange between Christianity and that selection of people groups. And out of that, you get the idea of the knight. So basically, the ideal of the knight is basically the northern like warrior tradition getting like digested and digesting Christianity. And the result is the ideal of the knight, the ideal of chivalry. C.S. Lewis has a really good article. It's like one page, but it's like a really good brief article called like The Necessity of Chivalry. And he basically talks about the ideal of the knight as something produced by Christian civilization and this like mutual interplay between the pagan world of the northern barbarians, the Germanic tribes, and Christianity. Pajot makes a point in several places that basically, if you look at the Vikings, right, the Vikings were just like raping and pillaging and basically contributing nothing to like world civilization before Christianity. And in that case, they become the Normans, right? And then they're the kings of England and of Sicily, and they're crusading, and they're massively more significant than they were before. And it's related to what we talked about in an earlier video, the idea of the image of the water, which is just like stagnant, it's in a swamp, it's not moving. And Christianity being like this aqueduct, which like orients the water in such a way that it can actually move and accomplish tasks. And you can think of it that way as well. So the kind of pagan barbarian north as being like raw potentia, raw energy, and it kind of getting given form and structure by Christianity. You can conceptualize it that way. But this process, it's important to understand, can happen with any group of people. So you can see this take place when St. Herman goes to Alaska, and there's the conversion of the Aleuts and the Alaskan natives. This process occurred all throughout Christian history, with all of its interactions with the people groups that it came into contact with, whether it's the Rus, whether it's the Norse, whether it's the Gauls, the Anglo-Saxons. And they always connect themselves to biblical history, which is like intuitive, right? Because it's the salvation history. It's the history of, you know, the origin of Christ, who is God, the God-man, the union of heaven and earth. But the classical element is interesting to discuss, because in universal history, they always connect themselves to the classical tradition as well, to the great epics of the classical world, you know, the Iliad, the Odyssey. And so like the Romans, the Britons, they connect themselves to the Trojans. And so you get, and you see that in the Aeneid. And so the classical element is important to bring in. And this would relate to, I think, what Saros talked about in several places about the idea of like, it's not accidental that the church kind of digested Hellenic philosophy. The classical world was not like accidentally, oh, we just like ran into, like, no, this was providential. And maybe Nate or you could pick up on that thread.
So with the Greek philosophers, I couldn't defend this idea, and Seraphim has taken down the video because he says it's not like up to standards, academic standards, I suppose, with the idea of how Greek philosophy came from the Hebrews ultimately, because it was the Hebrews who were in Egypt, and then his idea is that the Egyptians received Hebrew learning, and then that was developed and actually cultivated in Egypt. It's not like what Egypt gave to the Greeks was literally what the Hebrews had, but that he says there's an essential connection with the Hebrews there. And then so the Egyptians gave the gave philosophy to Greece. I think maybe some modern scholars like don't believe that, but literally every single text from the ancient world, where the Greeks talk about where they got philosophy from, they say it was from Egypt. So Egypt is where the Greeks got philosophy from. And so what you see with the Greeks, I believe, is that you see a sort of preparation philosophically within the mind of the Greeks for Christ. Because, I mean, Aristotle and Plato's arguments for some sort of first mover, for one, Plato's stuff about the good and about the one, all of these things were accepted into the into the church, obviously changed in some ways to and actually this is a hopefully the next podcast, but maybe not, but some podcasts we're going to do with Seraphim on the classical arguments for the existence of God and why within a Trinitarian or communal understanding, they actually work much better, because you actually do have a lot of problems with, for example, Aristotle's first cause argument, in his articulation of it, because there is no conception of some plurality or multiple persons, a way in which God could be moving in some way or expressing himself eternally, there is like this necessity of matter, like the necessity of create what we would call creation, and then God is dependent on something other than him, and that leads to all sorts of problems. It undermines the very definition of God. But what you can see, you literally have like this very polytheist society, which is ancient Greece, and then you have Socrates, who's obviously killed for the reason why he was convicted was undermining the Greek gods, the pantheon of Athens. And then Plato and Aristotle obviously have they were monotheists, even though you could argue that they didn't believe in a personal God. There are people who dispute that as well. But they did believe in this idea of like a fundamental being or principle uniting all of reality. And that's not what you get in polytheism, or you get some sort of really reductive, like naturalism, pantheism type idea, where what unites all of reality is like one of the elements or something like that. So what you see in the case of philosophy is you see a preparation for Christianity. And one of the ways in which we can know that is for the fact that they mirror a lot of biblical characters. For example, the main patriarchs before Moses were Abraham, Jacob, and Joseph. And in the case of Abraham and Socrates, and then there's Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, right? So Socrates and Abraham, there's a lot of parallels with them. Socrates is like this wanderer collecting followers, spreading his message. Obviously, Abraham's the same thing. He is wandering for the most of his life. He's accumulating followers and preaching the proto-gospel. And then you have Jacob and Plato, and there's a lot of similarities with Jacob and Plato, but the biggest one is the fact that Plato was a wrestler whose real name wasn't Plato, but his wrestling coach changed his name to Plato, which means buff or broad. And then Jacob obviously wrestled with God, and then after wrestling with God, his name was changed to Israel. And then with Aristotle and Joseph, but the main similarity there is they are both counselors to the most powerful king in their time. Aristotle was a counselor to Alexander, and then Joseph was obviously the counselor to Pharaoh. So you see all those typological correspondences there. Obviously, I mean, if you don't already accept the fundamental pattern and like idea we're talking about here, we got a lot of comments calling us actually crazy for this. But like once you obviously, it's all about presuppositions. If you accept Christianity, it doesn't become that crazy to believe. Now you're just sort of arguing about empirical facts, but your worldview is probably not going to change based on any empirical facts. So if this sounds crazy to you, I mean, kind of just bear with us, try and get to the more fundamental stuff that we're talking about when it comes to like this idea of communion and fundamental patterns to reality. And then we'll try to demonstrate, and not just us, so many other people do it way better than us and longer than us, like Jonathan Pajot and Seraphim, like these fundamental ideas that are and patterns that you see in reality that are best accounted for by the Christian story. But I brought up Alexander. I don't know if you guys have stuff to say about Alexander and where he fits in within a universal history narrative, because I know this is something that Peugeot talks about a lot.
Yeah, Alexander is super significant because he's kind of at the crossroads of multiple different civilizations. So kind of the Persian Islamic one, the Christian one, both East and West, and all the way out into like the Indian civilization. You can find he's like widely acclaimed, and there's all these different versions of his story stretching across the entire like ancient world, pretty much from Spain to India. That whole sphere has some relationship to Alexander and some consciousness of him. There's stories of Alexander rolling up to the gates of Jerusalem in his like maelstrom of conquest. Mm-hmm. And the high priest comes out of the city with the scroll of Daniel and says, ah, yes, you know, we've expected you, it's predicted that you would come and you would build this great empire. And so stories like this, the various Alexander romances that went around, are arguably represented in the Quran. There's this figure of what's this figure's name? It's Dhul Qarnain. And so there's these images of this like two-horned depiction of Alexander that you find floating around, and arguably that, so like basically Alexander's in the Quran. There's a good argument to be made for that, and so yeah, he becomes very significant both in like Islamic conceptions of like universal history and Christian conceptions, and he's a very pivotal figure. And of course he spread the Greek language and like Hellenism all around the ancient world, which created this common vocabulary of thought, which like basically Christianity came and slotted itself into. And it's part of, in my view, is providential for why Christianity became so big, because yeah, he really did create this like lingua franca of Koine Greek that was able to like create, to build dialogue between different people groups, and actually facilitated universal history in that sense, because it is what allowed for the, like that kind of Hellenism is what allowed for the unity of multiplicity in Christianity that occurred. And so yeah, Alexander's super significant, and yeah, he gets connected to you have it's the four, right? So you have like, you have Abraham slash Socrates, Plato, and Jacob, and then
Aristotle and Joseph.
And then there's a, yeah, so
are you thinking of another philosopher connection?
Who is?
Isaac as well, after Abraham.
As a patriarch, but if you're thinking of a philosopher, though.
No, I'm thinking of, so I know typologically that Alexander the Great, Sarah connected him to another figure, but I can't remember it exactly. It escaped my mind.
Oh, is it not Pharaoh?
After the patriarchs?
Yeah, it would be after, I guess Pharaoh works. Anyway, yeah, so Alexander's super significant.
In terms of maybe a connection there, like Pharaoh's obviously the one who facilitates like all of the nations coming to be gathered into Egypt to during the famine. So if you're talking about like everyone, like typologically, like we've never like actually talked about this before, but just off the top of my head, like if you're talking about like the Greek language sort of united everyone to hear the word, you know, which is the true harvest, right? Like the true
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think that works. I think that's why. Yeah, the Pharaoh. Yeah, that definitely works. Yeah, exactly. So Alexander, super significant in terms of universal history, both in like the Islamic and Christian world. Mm-hmm. And he did like, yeah, basically create this. Yeah, so he did. And it's not, the question is like, is this like a Babelian project? Is Alexander like Nimrod or something like that? Because he created one tongue, right? He created one tongue. And so that's an interesting question.
What about that story though, about that Peugeot always talks about with like Alexander, like going up into heaven, and then he reaches a limit, and then he like recognizes that would be like pointing towards it not being Babylon, if it is like, if he recognizes his limit, because that's precisely what the Tower of Babel doesn't do.
Right.
It doesn't have that moment of humility.
And this relates to, basically the way Alexander gets viewed in the medieval Christian tradition, which is basically he's like the height of human virtue, like apart from grace. Mm-hmm. So he like is like filled up to the top, but he doesn't overflow into like Babylonian territory. Mm-hmm. So you can think of it like that. And there's these traditions of him like, and that's the same tradition as him recognizing like the unity of God outside the gates of Jerusalem. Like, I recognize my limit. Like, and you can see this, like you can see this pattern weirdly in like figures like Napoleon, right? Like Napoleon, he goes to Aachen, right? Aachen is where Charlemagne was enthroned. He goes to the throne in Aachen, and does he sit upon it? No, he just stands there in awe. So he recognizes his limit.
He's too short.
Yeah, he couldn't ascend the steps.
Yeah.
even Napoleon like seemed to have like this kind of, and Napoleon, as far as I know, consciously modeled himself on Alexander.
Hmm.
But he seemed to like recognize his limit there, which is,
although there are other stories about Napoleon with like the Pope putting the crown on his head, and he takes it and seals it for himself. So, I mean, historical figures aren't like black and white, you know, but I mean, in terms of like the symbolism, you sort of do need to have this point where you sort of reduce someone to a pattern within the symbolism within the narrative, right? So like it seems to me you could make an argument that Alexander, even though probably historically speaking he wasn't the height of virtue out of every man who ever lived, like he probably wasn't as virtuous as like Job, but like he nonetheless, like
it's the height of virtue apart from grace. He's like the most righteous pagan. That's how
So that being the case, like he is fit within the story as like in a positive way. And I mean it seems to be because he's ultimately, I mean, you are positive in relation to how well you fit within, how the degree to which you are on Christ's side in the narrative in which Christ inevitably wins. Right.
Right.
But, so maybe like the final thing we could talk about, like in terms of the actual, like, historical side, we could talk about like, America. Because we've now talked about the classical culture, sort of touched on the Middle East. We can talk about America and where America fits in, because I think there's less stuff on America specifically. And in terms of like universal history, that makes complete sense because America is a modern country. Like it was created after in the modern world already after the Protestant Reformation. So in terms of like, if we're accepting, which is part of the claims I think that Peugeot makes, that the medievals and the ancients had this understanding of history and just fundamental understanding of seeing patterns in reality that that we don't see in the modern age, and that we're sort of trying to reconstruct now, we're trying to regain this this sort of understanding of patterns and symbolism. Even though it can be a little schizo sometimes, but I think overall it's a good project. But with America, there's less stuff on this. But I know you two have been working on this, like trying to. We don't want to spill the beans too early, but there is, like, you guys have been doing work on this, and you clearly are seeing there are a lot of stuff there to be used for a universal history project. So what is like? I have in my notes like the idea of like the fourth son of Noah. I don't know if that's like a good place to jump off into it, but yeah, it's up to you guys.
Yeah, so I'll just say something quickly on that and then hand it over to Nate because I'm sure he'll have stuff to say on this count. But yeah, so basically, there's this apocryphal figure, the fourth son of Noah, and he's referred to by various names in various like Eastern traditions, be they Syriac or even like Latin or Greek. It's usually something like Yonton or Yonaton or Yoniton or Yonithes or something, Yonithius. You'll find different names like that to identify this figure of this apocryphal figure of the fourth son of Noah. And the fourth son of Noah is like, it's a pretty widespread tradition, especially in the Syriac fathers and the Syriac Christian tradition. And so, yeah, so this figure crops up a lot in like kind of like biblical adjacent texts. Like for instance, there's this text here. I don't know if you can see that because it's like blurring the hell out. It's basically the Apocalypse of Pseudo-Methodius and an Alexandrian World Chronicle. Basically, it contains like, it's basically like a Byzantine world history and some like apocalyptic kind of prophecies. And the Fourth Son of Noah comes up in this context as well. If you want more information on that text, specifically those two texts, you should definitely check out Peugeot's series. But yeah, so there's this figure of this figure of the Fourth Son of Noah, and the idea that he's apocryphal like weirdly fit with the symbolism of the West. So if you look at the if you look at the sons of Noah, right, Ham is for the south, Shem is for the east, and Japheth is for the west. And so there's three there for the north. Excuse me. Yes, yeah. Japheth is for the north, and so that's basically how it gets broken down in all of the like classical all the ancient Christian sources, medieval Christian sources, is the Europeans are descended from Japheth, the Africans are descended from Ham, and the like broadly like the people in Asia are descended from Shem, with like some variation there, because it's definitely, there's like gray area, but that's like broadly how it's construed. And so basically, like, me and Nate had this idea that this fourth son of Noah, like, strangely fits very well with the idea of the West. If you've seen Sarah's discussion with Jonathan Bageau on like basically the symbolism of America, which they've also talked about in the Universal History series, like it's basically the place, like it's the place where the sun sets, and the sun is the source of like meaning, right? Because if you can't see things, you can't identify them. You can't obtain and collect their meaning. So the West is where the sun like sets, it like goes and fades out it's, you know, it dies. That's where the sun dies, and that's where meaning dies. And that's that ontologically, like this, like metaphysical or like phenomenological reality is like reflected in the reality of America as a continent, as a country, which is that it's like this like patchwork of different identities that don't gel together. And it's just kind of this like blank slate in which all these things are brought together, and there's no like real coherence. And then Pajot compares it to the whore of Babylon, actually. The idea of the whore as like the place where like identity just kind of like it's all identity is present and none at the same time. Like it because it's everything, it's nothing. And so that's kind of identity. It's the place where meaning goes to die, where identity goes to die. But that's like paradoxically related to like Babylonian like imposition of identity. And so that's basically America. And so the question is like, and that seems to be related to like, so because we broke down the three sons of Noah and the different directions to which they're allotted, the cardinal directions, like it makes very a lot of sense to basically connect the fourth son of Noah. He's connected to like Eastern mysticism in a lot of traditions, like the whole tradition of the gymnosophists. You can look that up if you want to know. But it's weirdly connected, I think, to the idea of the West. The fourth son of Noah is connected to the West. And that's like a very interesting idea me and Nate have been toying with. Maybe Nate, you can build on what I just said there. But
I don't know. I think you said everything there pretty much is to say without throwing too much information specific to our project out there.
But
yeah. Give us one example, a teaser.
Okay. Well, something that's interesting about the fourth son of Noah is there's traditions about him, how he taught both Nimrod and Abraham. And this connects to the idea of America, because America obviously is this place where it's kind of just this like pure, I don't even know how to say it. The way that you put it is kind of the best, where it's like this identity-less place that melting allows pot. For other identities to exist. Yeah,
exactly. Melting
it's
pot.
It's a melting pot, but the pot itself has no identity other than the fact that it is a pot in which all the other right. identities are brought together. It has no identity itself. So it's very interesting that this fourth son of Noah character, who is kind of identity-less, is the one who taught both Nimrod and Abraham. He's everywhere, but nowhere at the same time. And not just that, but he's responsible for teaching both the worst guy of the time and the most righteous guy of the time. And I think that we see something very similar in the West today, where there's this crazy, unbelievable development of not just technology, but of a cultural coherence between Christians and other people as well. There's this cultivation of a very deep, profound connection of man with the world and of man with man. But on the other hand, within the West, we also see the greatest alienation of man from man, man from God, and man from creation that we've right. probably seen ever. So
yeah,
the West is kind
of, you can see this quintessentially,
just becomes fully itself and then dies or resurrects.
Right, exactly. You can see this quintessentially in the idea in California, right? California is like the edge of the world. Like, it's like Pajot actually brought up the Red Hot Chili Peppers song Californication, and he's like, that is like symbolic gold, because that's the image of the West. It's like, you know, Californication, like that is the how you understand like America at its extreme. And what is California? It's like this place where it's like total debauchery, completely degenerate, completely appalling, all kinds of identities that don't gel at all, completely anarchic hellscape, but you also, and also completely like weirdly totalitarian, because those things go together, yeah. right? But also you have like Father Seraphim Rose and like St. John of Shanghai in San Francisco, and his relics are there. And you have all these like you have these like monastics, and you have like Father Josiah Trenum and his church. And like, you have these like
Tucker Carlson, have, like,
Tucker Carlson.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's this like place that contains everything. It's at the edge. It's kind of like, It's like the bottom of like a fish tank or something. Like it just connects everything. Like if you look, there's like filth, but there's also like pearls or something. It's like the bottom of the ocean. It just collects everything. Everything falls into it. It's like a basket or a net that just collects everything. So it's also an image of the ark, right? So this is where like America's weird, because it's like it's both like the most dead place. Like Alexander Solzhenitsyn. I'm not showing up here. Bro.
Hey, you're
absolute
gone.
bra moment. Let me, there we go.
They
Okay, might
got
have to cut
him.
that out. But for instance, Alexander, come on, man.
They got him again.
KMS, KMS. Okay, I can't do hand gestures because it makes me disappear. With no context, that's funny. But yeah, so Alexander Solzhenitsyn, he comes to America, he gives his Harvard address, right? And he says, you know, Sovietism kills your body, Americanism kills your soul. And so it's like the most dead place in a weird sense, but it's also like the place of resurrection. Because you know, like you have to, like, you know, Jonah doesn't like, you know, resurrect from the dry land. He resurrects from the belly of Leviathan. Like that's, so this is where like there's like a weird like ironic American exceptionalism that comes out of like an understanding of like symbolic, like phenomenological geography, like you could call like geosophy. Like there's a weird like American exceptionalism in that, like it's like because it's the worst place, it has like the most potential. And so this ties back into what we were talking about before with basically history always being one step backward, two steps forward. And yeah, so there's like a weird like blessing in North America, in being in the far West, that can culminate into like an image of the New Jerusalem, right? In where all the kings of the earth bring their treasures.
And like I think like fundamentally why the reason why there is so much potential in America relates back, at least from what I can tell, to like this biblical idea of dividing the wheat from the chaff. Because when you have this separation of good from evil, the good can know itself more. It becomes easier to know when you are on what side you're on, because that's what happens. You have like the it's really easy when you're a Christian living in California, it's really easy to know where you stand in relation to the society, the broader society and culture that you live in, right? When it could be more easy to become worldly in a more lukewarm sense when you live in a place that is less kind of like, yeah, like lukewarm Christian, or like not as completely fallen as California is. But the whole idea of resurrection is that that wheat is that is harvested, right? Like this is, for example, the martyrs in the early church. They are the first fruits, to use biblical language, of the church, which then it was through the sacrifice of the martyrs that eventually you had the situation that led to Christianity being preserved, and then the conversion of Constantine, and then the entire known world is redeemed. But in that, I think this is what you see with America and why it has so much potential. I think we're gonna have to end the call now, though, because I just got a call and I have to pick someone up. So I think this was pretty long though, right? This is like probably about an hour, so we did good.
Yeah, and we never even got to talking about Pentecost as the solution to Babel.
We're not gonna, we can't. I gotta go. I'll get in trouble if I don't. But
Part two.
yes, yeah, exactly. If Seraphim doesn't show up again, that'll be
We
next week's
barely scratched the
podcast.
surface, man.
Okay, but thank you guys. Any concluding comments, any brief concluding comments that either of you have or anything? Maybe what are the best resources, Allhart, to check out if you're interested in these ideas?
Yeah, so the best resources to check out are, one, you know, stay tuned to Telos Bound, and two, some literature to check out for sure if you want to know about universal history is, one, the Pajot series with Richard Rowland, and there's some other guest speakers there like Mario Bagos and these different figures, and also his discussion with Seraphim Hamilton, where they talk about America and like this kind of ironic like American exceptionalism that arises from biblical symbolism and universal history. And you can also like check out certain texts. One key one would be, I guess, the Golden Legend. If you're from like a Western background, it's basically like the collection of Western saints' lives, and it has a lot to do with universal history. There's also other things. Basically, there's like you can get just like look into like the national epics of certain nations, and also like the basically
especially your own nation.
Yeah, exactly.
Your own story.
So you can check out
gonna die in like 30
Saint
seconds.
Saint Bede's collected works, like Saint Bede's work on chronology. That's another one. Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, Alexandrian World Chronicle. There's tons of this kind of stuff. Just look like the medieval chronicles, the Byzantine Chronicles, connects to the Book of Enoch. It's all dope. You can just like start diving into it. So yeah, that's what I would say.
Real. And if you need any help with finding PDFs to this, join the TLS Band Discord and contact Woody Woo. Contact Woody Woo and you'll get your PDF. Okay.
We need a Jamaican world history. Woody Woo next podcast guest.
Yes, absolutely. He wouldn't show himself. It would just be, yeah. Okay.
And he would just occasionally say something like soup. Yeah. That gleam. Soup key.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you, everyone. Subscribe, like, join the Discord.
And God bless the USA.
Yes.
So true. Exactly. So true.